Welcome to the University of Washington's Political Economy Forum. We bring together diverse scholars, policymakers, and citizens to discuss current public policy issues, to inform the public about them, and to find evidence-based solutions. Feel free to visit our website at uwpoliticaleconomy.com. We publish new episodes of this podcast every week. If you have questions or suggestions for discussion topics, please contact us on Twitter at ForumUW or email us at uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Nicholas Wittstock, and today I'm speaking to Professors Judith Shapiro and Yifei Li. Judith Shapiro is the director of the dual degree in Natural Resources and Sustainable Development at American University School of International Service. And Yifei Li is an assistant professor of environmental studies at NYU Shanghai and global network assistant professor at NYU. Together, we discuss China's ambition to become an ecological civilization and to show the world how they can do it too. Hello, Professor Shapiro.
Good morning. Hello.
And hello, Professor Yifei Li.
Hi, Nicholas.
We're very happy to have both of you on. You are the authors of China Goes Green, Coercive Environmentalism for a Troubled Planet. It's a book about environmentalism under authoritarian government, I suppose, broadly construed. And I'd like to start with a quick discussion about, I suppose, the promise of authoritarian government in the context of environmental politics, because it's definitely not hard to find quite a few people who say things like, well, you know, authoritarianism is nice, but it might be necessary to implement the kinds of policies that are needed ultimately to bring human economic activity back into line with ecological limits of the planet. Why is that? How do we get here? Why is this a relatively common position at this point?
I'll start.
Please.
Yeah, Nicholas, that's a great point. It actually gets to the motivation for writing the book. I think that particularly with global biodiversity loss and climate change catastrophe, there's been a frustration on the part of many in more democratic societies, a feeling that our current global system is not adequate to the urgency of these crises. And so many people who don't know China and other so-called green authoritarian governments like Singapore, they don't know them very well. And so there's a kind of a notion that if we only had a green dictator, maybe that's our way out. You know, there's a longing for someone to just get up there and say, no more fossil fuels, no more single-use plastics. Everybody gets an electric car, you know, and then we could overnight create the kinds of transformations that we would need. So we wanted to investigate what this actually looks like on the ground in China, because Yifei, who lives there, has a different experience. And I've been an observer and frequent liver in China for decades and decades, have understood that oftentimes, this is kind of the takeaway message of our book, oftentimes the Chinese state wraps itself in a cloak of green in order to achieve certain kinds of controls over its citizens. I'm going to turn this over to Yifei, and he's going to explain our takeaway message.
I can go with that first. And I also wanted to say something in response to your question, Nicholas, about sort of this overarching Western admiration, if you will, for what China is doing in the environmental realm. But back to the earlier point that Judy was alluding to, is that there seems to be a lot of admiration for China on the note of authoritarian environmentalism. And because that is a term that has been used to imply that if we only use authoritarianism as a means towards the end of environmentalism, then great. This really seems to be the hope or the speculation that a lot of people was having when they looked to China. But after our systematic investigation in the book, what we concluded, in fact, turned out to be the opposite, is what we call environmental authoritarianism. In other words, environmental protection becomes the means towards the end of authoritarian control and consolidation. And that really is a primary theoretical argument that we wanted to advance in this book. It's not AE, but EA. But again, to your question, Nicholas, about the overall context that we're examining, one of the things that I personally get asked a lot whenever I give talks or just go visit other universities or just casually have a conversation with someone about China's environment, this issue of ecological civilization comes up again and again. A lot of people who command a good amount of knowledge about China would oftentimes look at ecological civilization and see an awful lot of hope and promise in it. And I think theoretically, this notion of ecological civilization does seem to have a lot of hope and potential. But in actuality, what we have found in our book is that ecological civilization has a lot of interesting qualities that aren't being fully articulated or not even being fully acknowledged by the party state itself. For example, when the Chinese state uses this notion of ecological civilization, really is sort of describing the party state as having this very, very central historic role in the history of China to revive China back to its former state of civilizational glory. Mm. Think about all the long history of China and the kind of civilizational power that it once possessed before its encounter with Europe. The party state seems to be very committed to describe itself and to portray itself to its own people as that kind of civilizational power. And they're saying that they're not just reviving China back to any random kind of civilizational glory, but a unique ecological kind of civilizational glory for the future. And that kind of promise really suggests to the world how environmental problems are so central to the Chinese party state. They're not getting rid of environmental problems, but they're using environmental problems very much to consolidate its place domestically and internationally.
Thank you. Yeah, Judith, Yifei brings up this notion of ecological civilization. When does this shift occur in Chinese policy, I guess, or just sort of declarations of what kind of developmental model China is pursuing? When does this shift occur?
Ecological civilization was enshrined into the Chinese constitution only in the last year or two. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of propaganda out about sort of Grandpa Xi waking up on the old Belt and Road and realizing that the world is so troubled and it's time for China to make a unique contribution to basically salving the wounds of the world. And the way to do that is to somehow go out into the world on the Belt and Road and create connectivity and win-win green solutions. And, you know, Uncle Xi is portrayed as, or Grandpa Xi is portrayed as an incredibly benevolent sort of a leader. I see in the news headlines today that he was very active in the tree planting day. And, you know, he's planting all different kinds of trees and saying that this is going to be green, green, green. So if you read the propaganda and the news articles, you know, it really looks tremendously exciting and kind of reassuring. But I think we should talk a little bit about what that looks like on the ground. And yeah, in our book, just to describe the book very briefly, it's based in spatially in four areas. So we start with the more developed eastern part of the country, the manufacturing hub of the world, where certain kinds of authoritarian tools are very much in use, like sudden campaigns to get a blue sky or target setting, where you have a very quantitative, you know, by this time next year, we must have 3.20% of X, you know, and certain kinds of behavior modification campaigns where, you know, what Yifei is experiencing now. Okay, we have COVID, nobody goes out, period, you know, or the more funny aspect of it is, I guess, get rid of the Beijing bikini, where old men are not allowed anymore to roll their undershirts up around their their chest to show their middles. Mm-hmm. Or the little grasses are very tender. Do not step on the little grasses. And anyway, then the book moves to the less developed western part of the country, and we explore green grabbing with building of big hydropower dams and how using sort of renewable energy percentages makes it that much harder for citizens who are affected by dams to protest, right? Because you say, the state says, oh, this is, you know, an international commitment. And so therefore you have nothing to say about it. And similarly, a campaign which is called Ecological Migration, where the nomadic peoples are being forced into settlements in the name of creating big national parks. The state is blaming these nomads, who are also ethnic minorities, whether Tibetans or Uyghurs or Kazakhs or whatever. They're blaming their animals for tearing up the grasslands. So the state has been trying to control these nomadic populations for literally millennia, you could even mm-hmm. say, and now they have a green excuse to do it. So you're using environmental protection to basically abuse people's human rights and to carry out a kind of, in some cases, almost a cultural eradication. And then the book moves to out onto the Belt and Road, and also some of the uses of technocracy or technological solutions to try to solve environmental problems. And it gets really, if I can use an informal word, kind of trippy at this point, because I mean, on the Tibetan plateau, for example, they're using silver iodide shooting machines to do cloud seeding. That's not just a temporary couple of machines, but they're actually trying to change the weather on the Tibetan plateau. And in outer space, you know, there's an outer space Belt and Road where they're using satellites and GPS and all kinds of monitoring to do sort of global land use changes, again, in the name of environmental protection. But if you're at all paranoid on the geopolitical front, you're thinking, wow, China has an awful lot of information mm-hmm, about mm-hmm. what's going on in the world. And they also have a lot of ability to use some of these technologies for military uses if they choose to do so. But that's a quick overview of the book. Yeah.
Thank you. That's amazing. I want to get back to at least a couple of those points in just a moment. But Ife, I understand that it's justified to be skeptical of China here in how honest or sincere, I suppose, they are about this idea of ecological civilization. But at the same time, I mean, there is some positive in this development, right? I mean, China is serious about trying to reduce the environmental impact of its developmental model in terms of, is interested in making Chinese people better off materially, but realizing that there are ecological constraints. So trying to somehow square these things. Is there not a positive through line here?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I don't think we are making a sort of a knee-jerk rejection mm-hmm. of whatever China is doing. What we're really trying to do in the book is to offer a balanced assessment, given right. the best evidence that we're able to gather, to see what are exactly the positives and what are the negatives. And in fact, more importantly, what is it that we can say about the mechanisms that produce these positives so that we can, you know, perhaps figure out ways to amplify the positive impacts of Chinese developments. And what we ended up finding is precisely that yes, there are a lot of positive developments and a lot of well-intended policies were able to achieve positive environmental and social outcomes, but that's not because of the Chinese state. Hmm. It's not because of the Chinese state's single-minded pursuit of these environmental programs, but because in some of these successful cases, the state actors remained very open mm-hmm. to a wide range of actors. They were able to solicit help and they were able to solicit inputs from all walks of life to ensure that whatever they ended up doing in their environmental programs, whether it's conservation on the Tibetan, on the Lhasa Plateau or some of the other places, they were basing their policymaking and decision-making on inputs from economists, sociologists, and ecologists, and the local villages mm-hmm. who had generations of experience doing conservation without actually calling it conservation, if you see what I mean. And it's exactly that kind of openness that led to a lot of successes that we documented in the book. And conversely, we were able to at least articulate the mechanisms that produced failures. The Chinese state is at its worst when the state is in its single-minded pursuit of certain programs and decides to shut itself off in a way, putting itself away from all sorts of voices that perhaps could seem to contradict what the state wants. And when the state does that, it's almost a sure recipe for failures in the long run. And in fact, as we documented in the book, some of the failures are quite immediate. So it really comes back to the central argument that we were making in the book, which is about this counterintuitive quality of China's brand of state-led environmentalism. It's counterintuitive because its success is not contingent on a very powerful state that's capable of doing everything. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, on the contrary, the success of that state-led developmental model is contingent on mechanisms that can place state power in check. And these are exactly non-state mechanisms that is so fundamental to the success of China's state-led programs.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of ironic in the end then, right, Judith? So ultimately, it isn't the case that authoritarian environmentalism seems to have any edge here, right? Because in your analysis, in exactly the way that Yifei is laying it out, it is not the cases where the state push all the annoying politics out of the way and just say, okay, this is what we're doing now. But rather, this is ultimately another case for pluralist governments.
Exactly. Public participation is essential to the success of any of these programs. And mm-hmm. the tendency of the state to do this in a very top-down way without consulting and without explaining mm-hmm. leads sometimes to unexpected negative consequences. I know when they rolled out a recycling program, a mandatory recycling program in Shanghai, they didn't tell anybody. They didn't explain it. There was no buy-in. And mm-hmm. so it was done in a way, at least initially, maybe there's more buy-in now that has been already in place for a year or so. But when they first rolled it out, they said, there's only 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours at night. You have to do it exactly correctly. We're going to inspect your bags. Mm-hmm. If you're not doing it right, your social credit score could be negatively affected. Or if you're doing it right, you could get a good social credit score. And as a result, at least initially, busy, sophisticated people going to work, they would bring their recycling with them in their car and throw it out onto the highway. So the result was even worse. And you know, also there was a question of environmental justice involved in the way this was rolled out, since in the past there's been an informal economy of recyclers, usually people from the so-called floating population who come in from the countryside and they go around in sort of bicycle-led carts where they'll go from building to building and collect the recyclables and all of that. And many of those people were disenfranchised, out of work, and they're kind of the lowest ranks of society. And that's one example of, you know, there has been since the mid 90s, a really vibrant environmental non-governmental association or non-governmental organization sort of movement ever since the formation of Friends of Nature. And generally speaking, since the mid 90s, there's been, you know, we talk about cold winds and warm winds in terms of Chinese political space for organizing, but there's been, you know, moments of more warmth, moments of more coldness, sort of expanding and contracting. But generally speaking, there's been a trajectory towards greater freedom. And that is not true, really, under Xi Jinping. Mm-hmm. Under Xi Jinping, that space has been steadily contracting. And so the risks to environmental activists, or I would even say environmental servants of the people, is becoming greater and greater. And just informally, I hear people saying, you know, I think now is the time for me to go overseas and get that law degree I've been thinking about, or, you know, now's the time for me to just, you know, write a book, whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yifei, I want to get back to this idea of environmental authoritarianism. So what are some of the other goals or other, state goals that China is seeking to achieve through this veil of ecological civilization. Mm-hmm. And how does this work out in practice?
Very, very good point. I mean, I suppose we can use a number of examples to better articulate what that really looks like. I mean, Judy has alluded to a number of examples how they would include in recycling programs a connection to your social credit score. Mm-hmm. And in one of the cases that we discovered after the publication of the book, some neighborhoods in Beijing were installing these facial recognition cameras right on the garbage collection cans, so that when people go throw away their garbages, they actually get facial ID'd immediately, and then the machine would immediately identify things that are not supposed to be there. And if you get too many of these reports, your score could go down, and that could affect how citizens can access banking credit, how citizens can be eligible for a train ticket, or sorts of benefits that ordinary citizens are supposed to get. But now these things are increasingly becoming contingent on one's social credit score. But even beyond that, in many of the Western ethnic minority regions, in the name of environmental protection, what the state has been doing is to systematically, quote unquote, urbanize these mm-hmm. people, in the name of building a hydropower dam, in the name of creating natural reserve or a national park. They've been systematically trying to control these folks to assimilate them into the ethnic majority Han ways of life, and at the same time destroying their lands, their ancestral lands mm-hmm. that have been theirs for as long as people can remember. And internationally, a lot of what China has been doing has been sort of in the name of environmental protection. Creating these high-speed rails, they're advocating for energy efficiency when they create these infrastructural projects, oftentimes without fully articulating negative ecological consequences, especially when their bridges and railways cut through sensitive ecological habitats. So they do purport to create an environmental impact assessment, but oftentimes in their environmental impact assessments, there is an overestimation of the energy efficiency benefits, but an underappreciation for the interconnected ecological harms that they are actually having. Also, perhaps another example that might interest your listeners is a recent one that Judy and I discovered, and again, after the publication of the book, was how they're now targeting environmental NGOs that collect a lot of environmental information on the Chinese coastlines. They're banning these environmental NGOs from pursuing these activities because supposedly the environmental information that they're collecting are now classified as national secrets. So it's a lot of sort of killing two birds with one stone, right, if you will. Whenever they do these supposedly green sounding things, there's never only one justification. There's a pretext that they would give as sort of an official discourse, but oftentimes there are simply a lot that's happening in each one of these programs.
Right. Yeah, it's a double win for an authoritarian government, I suppose, right? Being able to indeed, in some cases, at least improve your environmental outcomes while developing further, while still consolidating power at the same time. I want to turn to something that you discuss in the book as well, which is China's pretty aggressive efforts to try to export this model. At this point, I suppose China is one of the best, or I suppose most well-regarded models for economic development for poor countries around the world, and happens to also be a pretty successful authoritarian state, which a lot of poor countries at least aspire to be, or at least their leadership. So what are some of these efforts to export this model, and how does this go together with the effort of Chinese technology companies to try to export their products as well? You spoke about this with the term green technocracy. I think it would be fascinating if you could elaborate on that, Judith.
I think it's important to remember an historical context here.
Please.
In some ways, what China is doing by going out is in comparison to what the West did in its colonial and imperial era, a lot less violent. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's we should remember that this kind of neo colonial move that so many observers are afraid of is, after all, not done behind the barrel of a gun, which mm-hmm. just makes it really very different. And the Chinese would say that when the rules of the global system were being written, China was really on its back, being abused by the Japanese, the Western powers, you know, from the Opium War through that whole what they call centuries of humiliation. So now China is saying that it's simply retrieving what is its natural right as the greatest civilization in the world. And so I would say that, you know, we should also remember that the projection of soft power is not unique to China, that, mm-hmm. you know, in the US we have public diplomacy and, you know, all kinds of other ways to try to win the hearts and minds of the people in the world. The different moment is that in many ways the West has been in retreat, particularly the US, mm-hmm. ever since the Trump years, with, you know, unsigning the Paris Accords and basically falling down on its leadership. And so for a developing country that's still struggling with just basic capital, the arrival of China on the scene seems, at least in the initial stages, to be an incredible blessing. I mean, here these Chinese are with their checkbook open, saying, you want that dam, we're going to build it for you. You want that road, we're going to build it for you. You want that airport, you want that deep water port, we're ready to go. You know, and so there was at least this going out policy starts from the late 90s, and then it was sort of enshrined in the Belt and Road Initiative, which is not just across Central Asia and around South Asia, but it includes Latin America and the Arctic and everything. Everything's on the Belt and Road, right? So there was a kind of a honeymoon period, if you will. And then many of these developing countries found that the deal was not everything that they hoped it would be. Most famous example is probably the deep water port in Sri Lanka, where the Sri Lankans essentially took on too much debt mm-hmm. from China. And then they had to turn over control of this port, Hanambota port. They had a turnover. So the Chinese now control the port for 100 years, right on the doorstep of India, a historic enemy of theirs. So there's geopolitical ramifications to some of these. And many countries have started to either try to renegotiate some of the projects or are a little more hesitant than they were, at least initially. And the Chinese, to give them credit, are also saying, you know, we're new to this, we're learning quickly, we don't have any experience consulting with communities, we never heard of free, prior, and informed consent, we don't even know what indigenous people are, much less that there is such a thing as indigenous rights, you know, and so on and so mm-hmm. forth. So they're aware increasingly, I think, that if they don't use better environmental and social standards in these projects, they're going to have problems down the line, right? Some people say, you know, what the Chinese are doing, say, in the mining sector or other sectors is really not that much worse, or maybe not worse at all than what the Canadians and the Australians and the Americans have been doing for centuries. Yeah, as far as the export of technocracy, I think Yifei is probably better than I am at explaining some of those ramifications.
I was reminded, as you were asking your question, Nicholas, I was reminded of a comment that a good friend of mine from Nigeria made. And this friend of mine is actually on Chinese government scholarship, studying as a PhD student in China. And one of the things that he said about China was that the people of Nigeria look to China not only as a model, but as, quote unquote, a big brother that can show the way. Mm. Because they've been, as a country, they've been pushed around by other Western powers for a very long time. And it's not just them. It's a lot of developing countries in the world feel like they have not had a fair say at how things should be run. They've been pushed around by, you know, Britain, the US, the European Union, and what have you. And now they feel like China is this one outlier that has been able to stand up and say things that are quite different. So it does bring an element of freshness to their minds in potentially imagining a future for their own countries. Mm-hmm. So it's not surprising at all that there is a huge and a ready market
right.
for China's developmental expertise. Morocco, the UAE, and all sorts of countries in Central Asia, they're really craving for a different model, something that's different from the Anglo-American model that's been around for so long, and that frankly has screwed a lot of people in these developing countries. So they long for a change, and they look to China. And also, they're not only looking at China as Judy rightly pointed out, as someone who's had their checkbooks open, but at the same time, these countries are looking at China's domestic economic success,
right.
And they're saying that we want some of that stuff too. Mm-hmm. We want some of the good materiality that China has been able to deliver to its own citizens, and perhaps. They've been wondering if we just follow what they do, if we just buy their technologies, if we just learn their governmental techniques, we will be able to follow suit in the near future. So there is a real desire for that kind of illiberal political approaches to government. And I think, you know, we need to be very careful moving forward in acknowledging that. We shouldn't just dismiss that right. as a phenomenon. It's a real and a substantial problem in vast parts of the developing world.
Mm-hmm. And if I can add something though, speaking as an environmentalist, there's an incredible risk to that model, to the planet. So as long as our global system relies on looking for more and more resources to extract, looking for more and more markets to sell cheap stuff to, ultimately, if you buy into the notion that there is going to be a limit to growth and a limit to the planet's resources, then the Chinese model is not helping us out at all, right? Because if everybody in Nigeria is imagining that someday, you know, their town is going to look like Shanghai, the planet can't take it, right? Mm-hmm. So what we really need is an ecological civilization that has a very different understanding of the human relationship to non-human beings, to landscapes, you know, a much more, I don't know, if you will, humble approach to our global footprint, much more of a sense that, you know, of living what we call within our own subsidiarity, right? Where mm-hmm. we don't necessarily say, oh yeah, I'm going to send, you know, this stuff over there and import that stuff over here. Because as China builds all this infrastructure, you know, you may say, okay, this railroad uses green materials, but ultimately what it's doing is facilitating resource extraction, is bringing stuff to market. And ultimately, as all of this trade is going on, it's promoting more fossil fuel emissions. Mm-hmm. So I'm really kind of worried about this model in general.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, right? I think the real question is, what is the alternative at this point? Not just for rich Western countries, but for everyone else who's saying, you know what, very understandably, as Hefei and you, Judith, are pointing out, well, I'd like some of that, at least the positives, right? And if I have to incur some of the negatives, well, so be it. I'll go with the best model on offer. And right now, it seems that China is offering something that, as Yifei is saying, that there's definitely a lot of demand for. And it's very understandable that they would go for it. So the real tragedy, I suppose, is the lack of a viable alternative at the moment. That being said, I do want to return to this idea that it's not really all just about economic development while also selling it as a green variety of that, but it's really also the sell of authoritarian control over populations that is enmeshed or connected to, on the one hand, this idea of green being connecting it to something that is maybe attractive for other reasons, but at the same time, it's also deeply connected to technologies of oppression, I suppose, but also technologies of a new kind of economy. So Yifei, if you could speak to this idea of green technocracy a little bit more, yeah, I'd be very grateful.
Yeah, absolutely. Green technocracy, in my mind, it materializes in many, many different forms. for example, in terms of everyday life, it could materialize, it already is materializing in some parts of China in the form of a carbon individualized carbon accounting system, whereby the state would create, like it or not, a platform for citizens to actually track all of their daily behaviors, and it would arrive at a total carbon count in the end. And then ultimately the goal is for individuals to trade with each other when the government assigns carbon credits. Now, the danger to that example of a green technocracy is that carbon emissions is a fact of life on this planet for every single human being. When the government, in the name of limiting carbon emissions controls, has access to individual behaviors to that level, it effectively reduces individual citizens to robotic actants, if you will, to borrow, a term from European scholars, so much so that individual agency is reduced to a bare minimum, and individuals are merely becoming actors who act in compliance of a state order. But more broadly, a green technocracy can be seen on a global scale in terms of how our global climate negotiations are increasingly pivoted towards this idea that we can solve our climate crisis simply by looking at technologies. And they look to China because, look, China is the largest manufacturer of solar panels and wind turbines. And China is, in fact, also the largest user of solar power in this world. There's no doubt about that. But when the whole world only looks at technological solutions as though that no other solutions and no other changes are possible, then we're really sort of digging a technological hole while ignoring all the other important things about reducing, reusing, all the other lifestyle choices that we could pursue that's different from this monolithic view of material wealth. And we're limiting ourselves when technologies are being marketed around the world as this powerful solution to our environmental problems. But perhaps a more fundamental issue that remains unresolved under green technocracy is that the only reason that we're in this global climate crisis is that we've used a lot of technologies that emitted a good amount of earth warming gases, and all these technologies brought us to this mess. And in thinking that we can somehow rely on newer and better, if you will, forms of technologies to get us out of this mess is more wishful thinking than evidence-based policymaking, in my view.
I suppose a certain amount of technology is necessary. I suppose at this point, it would be necessary to define exactly what we're talking about, right? I think on the one hand, I think a pivot to other energy carriers is inevitable, rather integral to any kind of solution that would allow at least a decent level of material welfare. But that's neither here nor there, right? Because what we're really talking about with green technocracy, as I understand it, is the use of digital technologies to be able to perfectly scope, measure, and direct human actions at the end of the day, right? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's sort of a very central way for technologies to be deployed in the name of the environment to control citizen behavior, to control firm behavior at the corporation level, to monitor the amount of energy that they use in the pollutants that they emit. That, without doubt, is a central part of how technology is already being integrated into China's environmental programs and perhaps the environmental programs of many other countries now increasingly as well. But the danger of using that model, using digitized platforms to control behavior for environmental protection is something that we've discussed quite a bit in the book, which is that when a lot of these programs are focused on pursuing and fulfilling quantitative targets, oftentimes these targets may be very well intended at the beginning. And these targets may also make a lot of sense on a national scale, but it doesn't mean that these targets are effective for all of the locations for a country as big as China. And oftentimes when there's a mismatch, oftentimes when there's a circumstance in which these targets don't make very good sense, officials are nonetheless pressured by their superiors in Beijing to fulfill these mandatory targets. And that could mean a lot of devastation on the ground. That could mean a lot of mishandling by local officials. And in the end, the people and the private firms, and especially the smaller enterprises, are suffering the most whenever these targets go awry. And we've got several examples in the book when very well-intended national environmental targets are implemented, but they went awry on the ground at the local levels because central policymakers simply weren't sensitive enough to the diverse local conditions in all of China.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Judith, I'd like to close on the question of it does appear that environmental authoritarianism or authoritarian environmentalism is a dead end environmentally. Maybe react to that statement first, but the question that I would like to close on, I always try to have some level of optimism at the end of these things. Where do we go from here?
I mean, I don't know that dead end is the phrase I would choose. I think that there is a level of decisiveness, which is admirable in some of China's environmental policies. And we need to be decisive. We don't have time to twiddle our fingers at this point. But I think that decisiveness has to be a collaborative and transparent kind of a decisiveness. So you know, people say, well, you're saying this, but you're saying that. I mean, on the one hand, you're saying the state should be decisive. On the other hand, you're saying, but the state should like listen to everybody and have a whole conversation. So yes, both of those things are true. And so, you know, as always, they say, well, scholarship is so frustrating because it never gives you any answers. It just makes things more complicated.
Yeah, the world is complicated. Yes.
but let's see what there is to admire in China's model, but also be very, very careful. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. If I could add to that, I feel, you know, a lot of the times in broad political discussions, authoritarianism is pitted against democracy. Mm-hmm. But what we have found in this book is that authoritarian approaches can only succeed when there are democratic pockets within authoritarianism. And these democratic pockets turn out to be most resilient in responding to the climate crisis. What's so important about China is that we're by no means advocating for China to adopt some kind of Western style democracy. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, what we're suggesting in the book is that in Chinese modern political history, there is this element of political consultation that used to be very important and yet unfortunately has become sidelined in recent years. Political consultations used to be so important because it constitutes a very important power check mechanism to make sure that whatever the party state pursues is not so far removed from political and empirical reality. And what we really advocate is for a return to that model of governance where, yes, there is a decisive party at the very center that makes big decisions, but at the same time, these decisions are based on a broad base of support only, and that's only possible when political consultation mechanisms are fully revived to what it was back in the days. So I think, you know, there's a lot to be hopeful about. Because it's not like political consultations never happened in the history of modern China. It did. So we know it's possible. And we know the people in the government of China is capable of doing these things. And they just need to be reminded.
Thank you so much. Judith Shapiro and Yifei Li, thank you so much for being part of the forum.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to the Political Economy Forum podcast. Please feel free to listen to our other episodes on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You might also like our special podcast on election security, Neither Free Nor Fair, which is hosted by Professor James Long and is also available on all major platforms.
Our podcasts are produced by Morgan Wack and myself, Nicholas Wittstock. Our theme music was created by Ted Long.
Please feel free to leave a review as we're curious about your feedback. And if you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns, please contact uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.